everyone. Welcome back to the 388th episode of the Internet of Things podcast. This is your host, Stacey Higginbotham, and your co-host,
Kevin Toefel.
And we don't have a guest for you this week, but we have so much news, it's not going to matter. So we are going to be talking about this new deal and investment in ADT from Google and State Farm. It's a big deal for smart insurance. Matter is already here. You just may not realize it yet. Google and Apple both have events. We'll talk about anticipation on one, and we're going to miss the other one thanks to our recording schedule. We're also going to be talking about satellite IoT offerings, one from Vodafone on precision positioning and funding from another company. There's so much funding news this week. We're also going to hear funding from a chip company in the radio connectivity space and a connected vent company. They're back! We're also going to be talking about Ring's devices getting end-to-end encryption, some new skills for your Nest Hub Max, and I'm going to talk about my experience with the Philips Hue Tap Dial Switch as part of a bunch of other new Philips Hue gear coming out soon. It is going to be exciting. And as always, we'll have our IoT podcast hotline, and this week we're announcing our winner. We'll also hear from our sponsor, Infineon. But first, let's hear from another one of our sponsors. This week's sponsor is Silicon Labs, and it's specifically the Works With event, which is the go-to developer conference for building the skills you need to create impactful connected devices. This event is virtual, it's free, and it's next week, so register now at workswith.scilabs.com. Okay. Biggest news of the week for the IoT, probably not the biggest news anywhere else, but State Farm has partnered with ADT. They're going to be doing an insurance deal. We'll talk about that, but first let's talk about money, because State Farm is investing $1.2 billion in ADT. They're buying the stock, so that means State Farm's going to own about 15% of ADT, and Google also put in additional money into ADT. I don't know if y'all remember, but I think it was like 18, almost 20 months ago, Google actually did a big equity investment in ADT, and they did a deal where ADT would install and sell Google's Nest hardware. This week, Google committed an additional $150 million into what they're calling a success fund to support expanding access for more customers in the smart home. Okay, so there's a lot of money running around here. State Farm is making their $1.2 billion equity investment. That's buying stock and making that investment in ADT. They're also going to commit up to $300 million to fund product and technology innovation and marketing stuff. That makes sense because they're going to develop stuff together and then market it. Yay. Google is going to add another $150 million if certain milestones are met. And if those milestones are met, Google will actually give up to $300 million. Okay, so that's the money side. So basically, ADT is getting equity investment and then some
a lot of money.
Some fun money.
Yeah.
So what do we think this means and why does this matter? This is actually a big deal because for years, the insurance firms have been looking at IoT and they've been saying, hey, you think about things like per mileage pricing for insurance on cars. So, you know, charging people based on how they drive and how many miles they drive. That was one of the first innovations in basically taking real-time data from the IoT and using it to price insurance. In the smart home, it's a little bit different. We've long pointed out the advantages of having things like leak detection technology, better and smarter home security systems. And for the longest time, if you had a home security system, you could get like a 5% discount on your insurance. With connected devices, you could actually, as an insurance company, say, not only is that installed, but it's actually on and working. People use it. Now, that's going to make some people upset because the insurance companies are going to be looking over your shoulder to make sure you're using it.
That's actually the biggest difference to me. As you mentioned, the cars and, you know, maybe you plug in a dongle into a car from an insurance company and measures your driving. you don't do much else with a car. I mean, you drive it, you park it, you don't even use it 90% of the time. Most cars sit around most of the time. But your home is a totally different animal because there's so many different activities that can be monitored. There's so much more information. There are more people involved typically that I don't see an insurance company getting in any other way into the home. It's not like they were going to create their own monitoring products, you know, who would buy them, right? But by partnering, they get that foothold in the door with ADT.
Well, I thought they would actually create some smart home insurance products or would would incentivize people to adopt new technology. State Farm's actually been very innovative. They have a program where you can install the Ting fire safety plug thing that I actually run one in my house. And this device sits in monitor. It sits in an outlet somewhere and it monitors electrical arcs, basically electrical, not consumption, but weird behavior of my electric system, searching for fires. And insurance companies have subsidized the adoption of like devices like the Moen Flow leak detection system that tracks like the water flowing through your pipes. The Finn has another one that you can get discounts for that. So they've had those sorts of things for a while.
They're all one-offs. Now you can tap into a smart home platform or ecosystem with ADT and Google, and you can get much more information. And maybe they change rates based on, hey, these people don't turn their security cameras on. They're not even plugged in. Or this house sees a lot of alerts. There's maybe this neighborhood is sketchier than we thought, and we need to charge them more for insurance. I mean, I'm just thinking of different possibilities here. It gives them much more control over or much more information to make informed decisions about the rates and premiums.
True. And this is all, the deal with ADT is all security, although I can see ADT's getting into solar. I can see them getting into, right now, Google doesn't have leak detection. It doesn't really have, well, I guess they have the Nest, they have the fire safety stuff, the Nest Wave. It's no longer
the smoke alarms and
smoke alarms. So I suppose they could do that. I feel like a good partner for ADT or an interesting partner for ADT or a good partner maybe for State Farm would be someone like Resideo that has all of the things that I think an insurance company would want. They have the security, they have the water monitoring, they have electrical, they have all kinds of crazy stuff. But that's okay.
Maybe I'm not grokking the whole thing here. By partnering with Google and ADT, they're not just getting information about Google devices or ADT devices. Any works with Google product they could possibly get data from.
You would have to share that. You would have to voluntarily share that. Like my Finn is not connected to my Google stuff, believe it or not. I've got some leak detection sensors that I don't really use, but they're actually Honeywell, which is Resideo's brand.
Right, right. See, to me, this is a platform play more than an individual device play. I could be completely wrong. We won't know until we see how this all plays out.
Well, for most people, like for normal people, security is a long established insurance discount. So this is a good way to get insurance into this space and have people feel more comfortable. It is different to say, hey, we're just going to check to make sure you're turning your security cameras on. Do you want to opt into this for maybe a cheaper rate? And if so, great. If not, they might still give the discount for having it, but not for the additional information. Who knows? And this isn't so crazy. Vivint, actually, in March of this year, they hired a gentleman named Ron Davies as their chief insurance officer. So that's the first time Vivint, which is a rival to ADT in the home security space, they hired this person and they haven't talked about what they're doing yet, but it's pretty clear that they're also looking at the space. So for me, who's covered this for so long, it's about darn time, simply because I was talking to people back in like 2014. I was like, man, this smart home stuff is way too expensive. We're going to need like insurance companies or someone to subsidize it. And the insurance firms made sense because they got more information and it was advantageous for them to pay upfront for these devices in promise for not having to pay for all those claims that those devices could potentially prevent. This is a big deal. It is a big deal both for ADT. It's a big deal for State Farm because it kind of cements a solid and real relationship that they can point to, because they've had relationships with Google. They've had relationships with, you know, the company Ting. They've had a lot of these kind of trials out there. So this feels like a real potential product that could hit the mainstream, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And change the insurance industry. Dun, dun, dun. We'll see. All right. Other things we have seen. We saw Matter last week. If you were at IFA in Berlin, you saw Eve actually showing off their sensors working with other Matter-compatible devices. And this was notable because Matter is not formally out yet. It should be out this fall. I'm hoping for September. And the stuff that they were showing with Eve, they showed it interacting with some Google devices, which is unusual because Eve doesn't actually work with Android or Google stuff, technically. It was built for HomeKit.
Mm-hmm.
So this was a big deal, but...
but some people who actually were there at the event, I want to say it was the Verge story that I read. Let's just say I don't know that I would have shown this off because they were seeing latency of like a second or two between a Google voice command and then maybe an Eve device doing something. Additionally, because of the Wi-Fi saturation, they couldn't test it with a phone. It wasn't maybe the ideal place and time to show it off. I understand why they did. And it is a big deal, especially for Eve of all companies, because as you said, they've been HomeKit only since the beginning. And thanks to Matter, they will be able to have customers using Android devices or using Madam A or Google on their smart home platform. They'll be able to work with Eve devices. So I get it. But I'm just hoping that the final implementation is a much smoother experience. And with anything new, maybe we're going to see some glitches and all. But yeah.
Yeah. This is something that I think we'll start seeing more of once Matter launches. And like I said, I'm going to be doing this Matter panel at the Silicon Labs Works With event. It's free. It's virtual. The panel itself will be at 1 o'clock PT. So work for your time zone. And we're actually going to be talking about what it means when Matter hits the real world. And we're going to be talking about things like, hey, is Thread really ready for Matter? Because this is going to be the first time we're going to see Thread implementations. They've been getting it ready, but what's that going to actually look like in millions of homes? We're going to be talking about like level setting, because Matter has been promised to us when it came out. It was promised as this awesome interoperability thing. I think we've moved far beyond that in the 3 years it's taken to get us Matter. I think people might be disappointed because we're like, oh, Matter, holy grail. And it will do good things, but I don't know if it's going to do everything we think it will do or we expect it to do. And I think it's probably important to start talking about that.
I'm thinking most people will be happy. There will be others that have moved on from waiting and used, you know, vendor or brand built solutions that Matter will replicate in a sense. Mm-hmm. So they'll say, eh, Matter doesn't do anything for me, but it's just a timing thing. We'll see.
Yeah. So Matter is out there. The other things that I saw, just because this is fun news, if you've got the Flick buttons, which I own and use all the time because, you know, I'm obsessed with buttons, you'll see later. If you've got those, the Flick Generation 2 buttons and the Flick dial are all going to be Matter compliant. So sometime later this year, they'll get the update, which is really exciting. These are Bluetooth.
Yeah, you won't have to go out to the cloud then for...
Well, I don't know, because these are Bluetooth buttons. They're not Thread buttons. So I think if, so like I run a Flick hub in my home. It's this tiny little hub and it converts my Bluetooth button presses to Wi-Fi out to the cloud. So I'm pretty sure, because I don't know if there's a Thread button in the hub. If not, then it's still going to be.
They could do Thread over Wi-Fi though, no?
Yeah, they could. When Matter comes out, we'll see if I can turn off the internet and still have this thing control it. But that's good news. Like if you have these devices, boom, you will have Matter controlling the Gen 2 and the dial.
You had mentioned this in your story. Google has a sign-up sheet for developers to...
That's right.
Yeah.
So yeah, if you're a developer and you want to test out the Matter protocol on Google devices, you can actually sign up and get access to it. So this is for anybody who's developing for Google Home, basically. And, you know, if you do that, You do have to sign an NDA, so you can't tell us about it, but you know, that's okay.
Well, you could, but you'd get in trouble if we opened up our mouths.
Yeah. And we would, because that's what we do.
And we would. No. No, we wouldn't.
I don't know. And speaking of Google, they have an event on October 6th. And, you know, we were excited about this, but I don't know if we're going to be super excited about it, because it's probably mostly about the Pixel 7 is what we're seeing.
Yeah. If you're excited about their phones and the second gen Tensor chip, which is rumored to be inside the new Pixel 7, then you may be happy. There is a good chance that the Pixel Watch that was previously announced will be available, or at least be introduced. I don't know about availability. Be curious to see how that goes from a wearable standpoint, but I have so moved on from Android Wear and Wear OS that it's really got to wow me before I even take a look at it. You might be interested.
Yeah, they said they were going to announce additions to the Nest smart home portfolio. So there's probably going to be one or two things that we can be like, yay, knew this.
I would guess Wi-Fi 6E Nest routers.
Yeah, see, those don't feel smart home, but sure.
Well, no, but...
But Google thinks they are. That's fine. And we saw the FCC approval for the Wi-Fi 6E stuff earlier.
Yeah.
So that makes sense. They did a whole camera lineup pretty recently, like a year ago. So I don't know if we'll see additional stuff there. But hope springs eternal.
We'll see.
Today, which is Wednesday, even though you will get this, remember, we record this show in the past. So the Apple event is going to be happening, and we're not going to talk about it until next week or the newsletter. We'll talk about it in the newsletter. So that's happening. We must acknowledge that for all of y'all. And yeah, stay tuned.
It'd be nice if they talked a little bit about Matter and or I'm anticipating updated smart speakers from Apple, but it may not be at this event because they sometimes have a second fall event for the non-phone stuff. This is surely the new iPhone, Apple Watch, etc. So, we'll find out today, the day we're recording, and talk about it next week if they have it.
Yeah. To me, I'm excited about new devices. Like, you know, would I like to see, I think, buttons. Again, I'm going to just talk about it. I think
here we go.
Apple should have a button, a HomeKit button. I mean, like with Matter, actually, we'll talk about it in a minute. I think there's some really compelling button options there that I'd like to see happen. So maybe they don't need to launch any physical hardware. But the things I'm interested in are the chips on the phone, things like UDIP ultra wideband. So we can get some more contextual information from our devices. I'm interested in that on wearables and how those devices will play in a smart home. But I'm less interested in the phone infrastructure and the devices themselves and more on kind of the back-end support for making a smarter home.
I'm kind of in the same boat, even though I use an iPhone, I wear an Apple Watch. I mean, I don't plan to upgrade to either of those because I'm less jazzed about, you know, one extra new sensor, maybe a temperature sensor on the Apple Watch. Okay, that's nice. It's not a game changer to me. The phones, sure. I mean, they already have ultra wideband in there. Are they going to do something more with them? It's more interesting to me than, you know, can it do something? I don't know. It's more about the experience now, less about the devices.
Yes. All right. Now, we're going to take a quick break for a message from our sponsor. But stay tuned because we've got fundings galore. We've got some updates for devices that y'all surely use. And I'm going to talk about my review of the Hue Tap Switch Dial. There's too many words.
Hue Tap Dial Switch, I think.
Hue Tap. No, there's no tap. Hue Dial Switch. Switch Dial. Something.
No, it's the Hue Tap Dial Switch. I'm telling you.
No, it's. Oh my gosh, it is. I'm like, there's too many words. Okay. Yeah, we're going to talk about
that. It's not about the devices at all.
All right. So this week's sponsor is Infineon. Hey, everyone. We are taking a quick break from the Internet of Things podcast for a message from our sponsor. And this week's sponsor is Infineon. And I have Steve Robbins, who is a principal field applications engineer for radar, sensors, and RF components. Can you tell us what types of sensors are developers most interested in using for their IoT systems?
Well, you can really think of sensors as simulating the human senses used by IoT systems to measure characteristics about the real world and detect what's happening, and then translating that into the digital world. For example, MEMS microphones can simulate ears. Radar on time of flight can simulate eyes. CO2 sensors are, you could think of them as analogous to smell. And pressure sensors simulate feeling, so to speak. And all of these are useful for capturing information for the IoT. Millimeter wave radar is especially intriguing for many developers because it's so powerful and flexible, as well as autonomous. And because we're developing new generations of smaller sensors that use less power, more developers are able to consider them for their applications.
What type of applications are being enhanced by some of these newer generations of sensors?
I'll give you three applications we find developers are especially interested in: presence detection, security, and predictive maintenance. Robust presence detection without false triggering is quickly becoming a very common feature that more and more developers want to add to their systems. And radar has the sensitivity and rich data that can distinguish between people, pets, and inanimate objects, whether they're moving or not. Also, radar can't determine identity, so it has the advantage of anonymity over cameras in security applications. Radar sensor can be completely hidden to where you can't even tell where the sensor is. And pressure sensors are becoming so sensitive that they can be used for detecting doors or windows opening. And Infineon offers a solution with our MEMS pressure sensor plus MEMS microphone that detects the sound and pressure wave of a window being broken. And it's more than 99% accurate with very few false alarms. For predictive maintenance in systems such as HVAC or similar applications, a variety of sensors can be used with AI algorithms to precisely monitor the conditions of system components such as motors, fans, pumps, filters, etc.
So isn't radar difficult to use? RF is often considered black magic technology. So how can IoT developers use it if they don't have that expertise?
It's true that millimeter wave radar can be challenging when it comes to the antenna design in the gigahertz range and the algorithms needed to intelligently process that data. However, Infineon has 60 gigahertz parts with integrated antennas, so an antenna specialist isn't needed. We also offer a GUI and SDK with API to help with that burden of algorithm development. We even have one 60 gigahertz part that detects motion by itself with no external algorithm micro needed. And it has a binary output indicating if there's motion or not. This is beginning to really open up radar to new applications in IoT where PIR has previously been used.
Okay, and where could our listeners go to find out more about Infineon?
Visit infineon.com/IoT to learn how Infineon makes IoT work.
All right, we are back with satellite news. I guess we should really call that news from space. Anyway, satellite operator OQTech. They have secured 13 million euros in Series A funding, and that's about $13 million. This is really interesting. It is a company, I wrote about it a couple months back. They're trying to basically launch a satellite fleet that lets you expand your NB-IoT networks. They look like traditional cell towers for any device reading it. So it means you don't need specialized receivers on the end device itself, like a satellite phone or a satellite gateway. So the technology that OQ has developed is basically a way, because satellites travel so quickly around Earth, and it's very hard for passing off mobile signals and being able to follow a mobile signal that quickly, that's the technology they figured out. They basically figured out a way to account for the Doppler effect as satellites move and the signal distorts. So this means that your devices won't be more expensive. They're able to use a traditional NB-IoT or LTE-M modem. And that's also going to reduce the battery because it can cost a lot of battery power to send a signal all the way out to space. So OQ only has two satellites right now in low Earth orbit, and it has partnerships with some other satellite providers. But they want to build out a network of satellites, and it's going to take time, but they're hoping that this funding gets them there. So
I'm kind of surprised that they took a totally different approach than most or other companies. I won't say thinking geosynchronous satellites that are always in the same relative position to where you or a device are. Because they didn't do that, they have to build this type of technology, I guess.
Yeah, well, it's smaller low Earth orbit satellites, so it's not the bigger giant things. And right now, they can only send data 4 or 5 times a day when it's going to be in, again.
When it's in range.
Yeah, because it's a limited number of satellites, but that'll change. They launched their first 2 with $10 million in funding. So this presumably gets them another 2? I don't know.
I would say they could double their fleet. It sounds better.
Well, I mean, it would be nice. And it probably makes sense because right now we're seeing a lot of consolidation in the satellite business. A lot of companies don't want to launch their own constellations. Maybe this is the right time. You never know. I look at this business and I think timing is kind of everything when it comes to a successful capital intensive business. And so right now with the downturn, there's going to be less competition, possibly more opportunities for launch. So maybe they can do this a little bit more cheaply when, you know, 3 or 4 years ago, other companies trying to do the same thing couldn't. And then they got acquired. So we'll see. In other funding news, Morse Micro has raised $140 million. That is a huge Series B round. Morse Micro, you're like, who the heck is that? I'm like, I will tell you. They are the they are the chip provider making Wi-Fi Halo chips. Wi-Fi Halo. Yeah, if you don't remember, this is Wi-Fi for IoT, y'all. I have been so skeptical of it. This is lower powered Wi-Fi. It's still not as low powered as some of the other alternatives, like some of the mesh alternatives like Zigbee or Z-Wave, but this has a longer range and it uses less power and it's Wi-Fi. So they thought about, initially they pitched it for like the home so you could get into basements, you could put things out in your yard. But now it sounds like they're really kind of switching to doing more commercial and industrial Wi-Fi. Mm-hmm. That could be good. And again, the volume on Wi-Fi Halo, you can stick, they say 1,000 times more sensors. So we'll see. It's lower data rates. So when you go farther and you have less power, you're going to be able to send less data. These are all the trade-offs you're doing here. But it is better than traditional Wi-Fi. And a lot of companies really just like your IT department does not want like 16 different types of networks if they can avoid it.
Right. In their press release, they say one access point can support more than 8,000 IoT devices. So, you know, it's not something you're going to do on a traditional Wi-Fi network.
Right. And I can see, like, imagine, you know, 8,000 is not a lot of devices if we think about sensors, right?
Relatively speaking, no.
But if you imagine like a super low powered kind of gateway that's, you've got sensors, you're sending the sensor data in, that gateway is performing a quick local like inference, so machine learning on that gateway really fast and using low power, you could then send that data if a state has been reached, or maybe just once a day, upload not the actual full data, but just the insight, basically. Upload the insight.
Right.
That could be a way to, like, I guess, create a Wi-Fi network. I don't know.
I mean, it sounds interesting to me because of what it provides, but I think the best use case is one you mentioned and maybe industrial, but two, I'm not so keen on, and that's smart cities.
You know,
I just don't see a lot of movement there.
I think the movement in smart cities is real low key right now. And well, this will be in the newsletter, but we'll probably talk about it next week after I get back from the Silicon Labs conference. There's a technology called Wi-Sun that is really going big in smart cities. So there's going to be some competition there. I'm fine with that. More competition, better on the, you know,
sure,
but
sure.
We'll see. All right. Other funding news. Flare. This is a blast from my past. Flare is a smart vent company, and they actually raised $7.6 million in Series A funding. And this surprised me because
it just disappeared.
It did. And like the smart vent companies, they were a big thing like earlier in the IoT. And then the HVAC people were like, no, you can't do this. It's silly. And a lot of them went away. So like, EcoVent was one of them. They were sold. Keen was also sold. And that just left Flare. And there's a company called Alia Labs. They're out there. So now the pitch for smart vent companies is this is going to help with energy consumption and possibly address like air quality. So smart air vents could help you with air quality. And last week we actually saw a smart air filter company. So there's clearly interest, there's money funding into this, so good for Flair.
So I just want to say that I've always wanted to buy the Flair smart vents. And one thing has held me back, and that is the price. These things are, you know, in theory, they sound great to me. They work with my Ecobee, for example. The room sensors tie into their Flair puck. So you can monitor temperature and possibly, I guess, air quality in different rooms. Yeah, I have a single zone heating cooling system across three floors. So, you know, this would kind of give me not really a true multi-zone system, but it would simulate one to a degree. And that would be nice. But these things are not cheap. I mean, just for one vent that would open and close automatically based on, you know, the sensor readings and so on, it's anywhere from $89 to $109. There's a starter pack with a vent and the puck. It's like $200. Okay, I get that because you're getting the puck. But when I start adding up all the air vents I have in this house, I would probably spend $1,500 on these smart air vents.
Yeah, you would. But maybe you don't do
no,
it.
No, I won't.
Well, I mean, over time, could you save on AC? And the answer
true.
Could be. I mean, like, I think there's an interesting shift happening. Like, I've always worked from home. So when I got my Nest thermostat way back in like 2012, 2013, whenever they first came out, I didn't see the massive savings because I work from home.
Right, right.
And so that was a little disappointing. Now with more people working from home, something this like this, if you're staying in your same study or office and everyone else has gone, you could actually see those level of savings. Just by only kind of cooling for the room you're in and focusing the airflow here and nowhere else, because you could cool that room down faster and whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I could close the vents in all the other non-occupied rooms and just open the vents in the room that I'm in. Absolutely. I'd have to take a look at some data to figure that out. And it's not like you'd recoup that money very quickly either.
No, you wouldn't. They also work with mini splits. So if you get the puck, it will actually communicate back with your mini split that it's fine, which if you've ever dealt with the mini split, they cool right where they are. Usually they're like right here. We have achieved the temperature and like across the room, you're like
the rest of the house. We don't care.
This makes that work a little bit better. All right. Moving right along. Small device news. Ring has finally brought end-to-end encryption to video doorbells.
Yeah, the battery powered.
The battery powered ones, and I think the battery powered security cameras. Yes.
Correct.
So they had added that to their hardwired devices and the plug in devices, but now it's power efficient, I guess, is what's happening. The reason you would do this is because you don't want law enforcement to access your Ring data. But if you do this, end to end encryption does mean that if you cannot access the data, if you lose your like phone and you cannot see the data because it is encrypted, if you're not on the right device with the right password. So,
yeah, you give up a little bit of, I would say, minor convenience, but you gain the ability to kind of control who sees and who doesn't see the video footage.
Yes. So, yay. Nest Hub Max. Kevin, you want to talk about this and why it's not as great as we think?
Well, it's a step forward for Google. And we talked about this, I don't remember when, within the past, I'll say 2 months or so, we had heard that the Nest app showed hints of this coming. Basically, if you have a Nest Hub Max, you have a feature called Quick Phrases. So that way you can skip the wake word. You don't have to say, hey, G, turn on the kitchen lights, for example. You can just say, turn on the kitchen lights. There is a bit of a catch, though. Because your Nest Hub Max won't hear the wake word, you kind of have to, I'll say, program it. You have to kind of create these quick phrases. And Google gives you some suggestions, like what time is it? So that's kind of like built in, or you don't have to say, hey, G, what time is it? But if you want to create custom or you want to use custom requests or commands without saying, hey, G, you kind of have to set them up yourself, which that's kind of I'm kind of meh on that part.
Yeah. I always hate, you know, anytime I have to go into an app on a voice control, I'm like, oh, you have failed. You have failed me. But that's okay, I guess. I wish I could be like, hey, G, set up quick phrases, and then we could just get there. But
yeah,
that's okay.
No.
Fine. All right. And Philips Hue, this happened last week, but after the show. Philips Hue basically is doing a couple cool-ish things, new lights.
They're always coming up with something that's really unique looking and very functional. And they're
very
light
expensive.
Guide, and very expensive, yes. The light guide bulbs don't look like traditional bulbs. They'll cost you $75 to $90 later this year, Q4 availability. They have some new pendant cord lights in black and white for $50. I kind of like the new white ambience filament candle bulbs. $45 a bulb or a two-pack for $65. So if you like candelabra-style lights, you know.
You can spend a lot of money on.
Considering you probably spent a lot on that candelabra, then.
Yeah, but
you know,
candelabras have a lot of light bulbs in them. I mean, I had candelabra-style lights. They had like 9 light bulbs. That's a lot of money.
Yeah. I also like, because I have some down lights in my kitchen area, and they're LED lights, but they're not smart, not by themselves. I have a Lutron switch for them, but they have new Philips Hue slim down lights for $70, and those are available now. So you just can take out your bulb and your recessed bulb and put these candle lights in, which is nice. And then some gradient light strips for PCs and monitors and such, which kind of replicate the whole play experience, which somebody has won from last month.
Yes.
But we'll get to that in a little bit.
Stay tuned. And you have it. And so this is helpful to you because they're going to combine the Sync app that you're using and that someone won with the normal Hue app.
Yeah, that's always been confusing to me. When you have Hue bulbs, you use the Philips Hue mobile app. And then if you have anything in their play line, such as the Sync hardware that synchronizes video with a TV or a monitor and colored lights on that you put up, that's a separate app. And I'm like, why? So I've had two apps all this time, and they are now integrating them into one, which is the way it should be.
Oh, and just so you know, you can now get Hue Sync directly in the SmartThings app. It does say that it's on your Samsung Galaxy smartphone or tablet, so I don't know if that works with the SmartThings app on other Android devices.
I believe it is a
Samsung
semi-exclusive to Samsung phones. But
all right. Well, I have a Samsung phone, so I'll play with that. But yeah, so some fun things. I am excited. Like, I actually think the slim down lights could be pretty cool for me because I have lots of can lights, and right now I've made them smart at the switch because the Philips Hue lights, again, super expensive. But if you're like doing a renovation or something like that, maybe it makes sense. All right. Now on to more exciting Hue things. I got this right before last week's show. This was the, oh man, just too many words here. The Hue tap dial switch, and just so many words. What this is this is $49.95, and it's a dedicated button that also has a rotary dial. And that means it can do dimming, which is really exciting. And the buttons, there are 4 different buttons. It reminds me of, so I'll just tell you my long history. I first bought my first Hue button like back in 2013 or 2014. It was the Hue Tap. This was a piezoelectric, which means it was self-powered. It had 4 buttons, and I loved this thing.
Was it Bluetooth?
No, or? It's Zigbee. It's Zigbee, and it works with a
Zigbee,
Hue Hub.
Okay.
So I should always
that's right.
say
back then they were Zigbee. Yeah.
Yeah. You got to do the. They're still Zigbee. There. You got to do all the Philips Hue stuff needs the hub. So I bought. And I think this was like $70. I mean, it was kind of expensive, but it was a fun device, and I still have it. And you know what, y'all? It still works, which is pretty cool because it's almost 10 years old. And then I bought for $30 a Hue button, and it's just a smart button, is what they call it, and it just I can click it 1, 2, or 3 times. And then I think there's a long press too. And that controls a series of lights, and or it actually controls my bedside table lights. So when I'm going to sleep at night, I can just turn it off with a button instead of talking if my husband's asleep. Very nice.
And that's just a small little button.
It's a tiny little button. It's like the size of a quarter. The tap is much larger. It's like 2.5 inches across. We'll call it 3 inches across. And this is about 2.5, 2.25 inches. So the tap dial switch, it's terrible. The tap dial switch is heavy. It's got a magnet. It comes with a plate so you can mount it on a wall. I don't think I would ever mount this on the wall. It comes in white and black. And it has like infinite options. If you are a die-hard Philips Hue light bulb user, this is going to be an amazing device for you. If you're like me and you've maxed out at like 50 Hue bulbs running around your house, you're going to love it. When you buy it, it sets up to control the lights in one room. This feels like overkill for one room unless you just have some like really complicated lighting in here, because you have, like I said, the dial for dimming, you have the four buttons that are programmable, and then each button, if you press it again, it will cycle through a smart, like through a scene. So I set mine up to control my Hue lights in my bedroom. The downside is then you've got to walk around with your Hue lights. I put everything in my bedroom because when I'm going to sleep at night, that's when I tend to want to turn everything off. Plus, I have the tap that controls my living room lights. I could also leave it in my living room. Anyway, okay. So I set it to control, like the first button, I programmed it to control like all lights off. So it's like, it's bedtime, all the Hue lights everywhere go off. And I have them in about five different rooms in my house, including my storage closet. Then I program the other one for my bedroom lights only so that I cycle through some different scenes in my bedroom. And the dimmer, once you click the button, the dimmer controls the lights that you're controlling, basically. So if you do a long press, you will turn off the lights that you controlled with that particular button. You can also dial the dimmer thing. So Hue thinks you're going to use this in one room and set like different light settings, like maybe on at full percent, on at 50%, and then you can use your dial thing, or on at energize, but you can also still energize as one of their light settings. You can also just skip through by pressing the button. Anyway, there's a lot here. I have not managed to max out anything here. What I'm really excited about, and I'm excited about Matter because I still have, despite having so much Hue gear in my house, I actually still have other types of lighting, like Lutron lighting. And I have like my Lutron light switches. I have some Nanoleaf bulbs. I would love to be able to control my Nanoleaf thing with this because I think it would be pretty compelling. Right now I use a Flick. Oh my God, I'm just thinking about like in the world of Matter, I'm going to have to rejigger all the buttons.
Oh, all the buttons. I've not been a big user of buttons, but this particular product is compelling, not just because of what you just said of maybe controlling other lights, you know, that are not Hues, you know, via Matter, but because I cycle through four, maybe five scenes right here in my office where I have a set of Hue lights and play bulbs, and I have to use the app to do it. I mean, I could do it by voice as well, but you know, I tend to just go into the app. If there's a button that I could like just cycle through those scenes quickly, oh, that would be awesome.
Yeah. And there is an option in the app. It doesn't work right now, but it is an option to configure the tap dial in another app. And The Verge reports that Signify, the company that owns Hue, that Amazon's Madam A will be one of the apps that you can set up the tap dial in. So that actually would allow you to control like possibly a routine or something with this button. And again, this is kind of like a cool Matter thing. So maybe I could actually control, I'm trying to think of how it would work to control my Nanoleaf stuff because Nanoleaf is Thread. I guess in the Hue hub that's local, it could talk to, I'm like, could it talk to, I don't know.
What talks to what that works with what? I mean, ideally everything will talk to everything and just work, but we have to wait and see.
Yeah. I'm going to have to program it in an app. And we'll figure it out.
Yeah.
So we'll see. Yeah. I mean, this is where the Matter will meet the road. And we're all going to be like trying this out. Like once it comes out, we're going to update everything and we're just going to run into some problems. And when we run into those problems, we'll explain what we're running into. We'll talk to people and we'll get it all figured out. It's going to be great.
And what was the cost on that again? Because I am interested. It was
$49.95.
I could do that. That's much cheaper than a smart vent.
And eventually it will be HomeKit compatible too, because once again, Matter. Mm-hmm. And Hue's always supported HomeKit through the hub. So,
right.
Hue does have a dimmer switch, I should say. So, you know, if you're thinking like, I need a dimmer switch for my Hue bulbs, this is an option, but they also have an actual dimmer switch. It's just kind of stupid because you have to like press it a bunch of times to dim. You're like, damn. Anyway.
I mean, at that point, buying that, I mean, you're not going to spend that much more. You're going to have much more control.
It's a nice UI. It's got a little clicky, the rotary dial is clicky. So,
you know what it reminds me of? Not that I've used it, but I've seen it, is Microsoft actually makes like a puck for their studio desktop for Zooming content creators would use it. Yeah. I mean, obviously it's not a smart home thing, but the look of it and the functionality and context, you know, just reminds me of that. And I always like that device. It looked like a well-made device that would be, you know, easy to use and intuitive.
I don't know if I would call it intuitive. They've made some improvements. So like in the first Hue tap, they have these little dots to indicate what button you're pressing. So it's a one dot, a two dot, a three dot. In the first version, those dots were just like printed on. They weren't raised. In this version, they're raised, which is nice because it gives you one.
You don't even have to look.
Yeah. It gives you that tactile kind of thing to tell you. So that's handy if you're vision impaired. But it's also just handy like as a, okay, you know, especially because you're dealing with a rotary. Maybe that's why they did it. So you could be like, this side's up. Anyway, it's a nice device. It's hefty. The only Hue device that I really hated was actually their Switch because I felt like it was cheap. It was the first generation of their Switch and it was ugly and it was cheap and I hated it. They improved it. So their second generation Switch was much better. But for the most part, Hue devices are, they're pricey, but they're nice. They work really well.
I'm ordering one for my office desk right now.
Okay. Congratulations. Okay. Well, that brings us to the Internet of Things podcast hotline and this month's winner, which won, this person won a Hue Sync system. Yay. Which is what Kevin owns. It is a box that plugs into your TV or your monitor and then the sets of lights that match the lighting color to what's playing on your screen. So it's pretty cool. Yeah. You like it, right?
Oh, yeah. I love it. I use it every day. I'm using it right now, even though I'm not syncing the monitor with color. I've got ambient color that matches the Hue bulbs to the left and right of the desk. So I've got a whole beautiful nebula scene going on right now, which is easy on my eyes.
Nice. Well, this month's winner, and thanks to everyone who called in, is David. And David, you called and asked us about Madam A and duplications. And I have to tell you that we actually answered that question. So when I text you to that you won, I'll also send you an answer to your question because I hate to think that you're missing out. Congratulations, David. And for the month of September, you know what? I like this thing so much. Let's give away a Hue tap switch dial switch tap switch.
Tap dial switch.
Tap dial switch. So we're going to give that away to y'all. So give us a call and you will be entered to win that device. And I should remind you that the IoT podcast hotline is sponsored by Silicon Labs, specifically the Works With conference that I told you about earlier. It's happening next week. You can register for free and it is virtual. So go to workswith.scilabs.com to register. This is going to be a must attend event. If you are in the smart home, you're going to be learning about Sidewalk, Wisun, all kinds of great things, Matter. So register for that event. And thank you, Silicon Labs, for sponsoring the hotline again. If you would like to be entered to win that, oh man, this is going to be a terrible giveaway because I'm never going to remember the tap dial switch. You need to give us a call at 512-623-7424 and ask us your question. Or you can just say, hey, I'd like to win. But we really like answering your questions. And speaking of answering a question, we've got one this week from Sam, and he's got a question about a button for his MyQ. Let's hear it.
Hi, this is Sam from Cleveland. Hi, Stacey. Hi, Kevin. And my question is about replacing the garage door opener. I have a detached garage, and when on this week's show, you guys were talking about Chamberlain's changing some of their support, it made me think about how can I replace my existing garage door opener? It's a Genie brand that has the little black plastic remote that you clip onto the visor. I use one at home to open the garage from inside the house because my garage is detached. I would like to see see if I can replace that with some sort of button that can be programmed to trigger my Chamberlain MyQ garage door opener. I know I can do it through the app, but I would like to be able to have my kids, my young kids, be able to open the garage to get outdoor play equipment in and out. And right now they're using this old Genie garage door opener. So I want to see what your recommendation is for a smart button to be able to do the same thing, since they can't control it through the app or through the phone. Really enjoy your show. Thanks.
I think he knows how much you like buttons, and that's why he asked this question.
Yeah, probably. But unfortunately, yeah. Sam, MyQ is a beast of a thing to integrate with other
yes.
stuff. They don't do a lot of integrations, and the one that you're going to need if you actually want to keep your MyQ and do like a button, it's going to require you to A, buy a button, B, buy a MyQ subscription to IFT. You don't have to, unless you're using IFT and you have more than three recipes, you won't have to buy a subscription to IFT, but it's a lot. So the way to do that is to spend a dollar a month for your MyQ IFT subscription and then go down. IFT supports lots of buttons. They support the Flick buttons. So you're going to, you know, you could buy that. They support other buttons. A lot of those buttons are going to have a hub because they're battery powered. So they're going to be Zigbee or Z-Wave, which means you might have to buy a hub, which you're not going to love. So that's one option.
That's one option. And the thing is, we don't know if Sam has any kind of current smart home ecosystem hub platform going on right now. We only know that he's got the Chamberlain MyQ. So if, Sam, you have, gosh, anything, HomeKit, Amazon, Google, smart things, I don't know that I would stick with Chamberlain's MyQ at all, because for about $40, you could get the Miros garage door opener that I have. And at that point, there's no subscription, first of all. That's one of the benefits. Two, it works with all the different platforms, so that's another benefit. You would still need some type of button, though, for the kids to integrate with this, because it's either a voice assistant or an app to open up and close the garage door. I tend to use my voice assistant on either my watch or a smart speaker around the house. But again, I don't know if you have any of those. If you do, it's worth considering, because it gets you, not that I'm trying to steer you away from the MyQ ecosystem, but it is a very closed kind of thing. To be honest, though, after Stacy and I talked about this for a while, because there are so many different options, I think I would make a simple choice here. You're already using the Genie garage door buttons that you put in like in a car visor, or in your car's dash, storage area. Why not just spend $35 and just get another one? And you can have it learn the frequency for your particular garage door opener. They all have specific frequencies, and just tack it up on the wall with a command strip for the kids. I mean, it's simple and it's cheaper and it's less maintenance. You'd still have your MyQ notifications because you're not getting rid of MyQ at that point. So maybe the smartest thing to do is not use a traditional smart device and just get another one of those Genie buttons.
That's honestly what I would do. I mean, especially since you're not trying to do any sort of like routine or automations.
Right.
Yeah.
This is just a convenience thing for the kids, which I totally get. You know, you don't want them using your phone all the time to open up the garage to get their toys and close the garage. Just get a Genie remote.
Yeah. Or, they also have like the lock pads. I don't know how old your kids are. Then you could just do a code and put it on the outside of the garage door. I mean, we had one of those in like a bunch of our homes, actually. They were really handy, and you just punch in a code and then the garage door opens. You obviously should not stick your Genie garage door opener on the outside of your garage if there's not a code.
That is correct.
So that's our warning for you. Hopefully we've helped you out there, and thanks for giving us a call. Remember, you can call us and you'll be entered to win that Hue Tap Dial Switch.
Yay, you got it.
At 512-623-7424. And that concludes this week's show. So thank y'all for listening. We will see you next week on the show. And if you get bored or want more IoT information, feel free to sign up at stacyonIoT.com/newsletter for the weekly newsletter. It's free and has more information available for you. Thanks for listening. And that concludes this week's episode of the Internet of Things podcast. Please join us next Thursday, and don't forget to subscribe. And if you can't get enough IoT news, I would love for you to sign up at www.stacyoniot.com for our weekly IoT newsletter, where we explain all kinds of things that we don't even get to on the show. Once again, thank you for listening, and please subscribe.